The following program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.
This is Charles Ruas welcoming you to a program from my audio archives from the 1970s. As Director of Arts Programming at WBAI-FM, the Pacifica radio station in New York City, I produced programs that covered all the contemporary arts, including drama, literature, and experimental radio programs as well.
With the cooperation of Clock Tower, these programs have been restored for broadcast on Clock Tower Radio, operating at clocktower.org.
Flight to Canada.
I'm so glad I crossed over the line. I'm so glad I crossed over the line. The line that separates the darkness from the light. I'm so glad I crossed over in time. Let's tell them again.
Ishmael Reed, Flight to Canada.
Dear Amasa Swill, what it was, I have done my lives a leap and am safe in the arms of Canada. So ain't no use of your slave catchers waiting on me at trailways. I won't be there. I flew a non-stop jumbo jet this AM, had champagne compliments of the captain who announced that a runaway Negro was on the plane. Passengers came up and shook my hand, and within 10 minutes, I had signed up for 3 anti-slavery lectures. Remind me to get an agent. Traveling in style beats craning your neck after the North Star and hiding in the bushes anytime, master. Besides, your Negro dogs of Hayes and Allen stock can't fly. By now, I suppose that yellow Judas Cato done told you that I have snuck back to the plantation 3, maybe 4 times since I left the first time. Last visit, I slept in your bed and sampled your cellar. Had your prime quadroon give me she back. Yes, yes. You was away at a slave auction at Ryan's Mart in Charleston, so I knowed you wouldn't mind. Did you have a nice trip, master? I borrowed your cotton money to pay for my ticket and to get me started in this place called Saskatchewan. Brr. It's cold up here, but at least nobody is collaring, hobbling, gagging, handcuffing, yoking, chaining, and thumbscrewing you like you was a hobby horse. The mistress, Miss Lady, give me the combination to your safe. Don't blame the feeble old soul, Captain. I told her you needed some more money to shop with, and you sent me from Charleston to get it. Don't worry, your employees won't miss it, and I accept it as a down payment on my back wages. I must close now, Massa. By the time you get this letter, old Sam will probably took you to the deep six. That was rat poison I left in your old crow. Your boy, Crickskill.
Tell him again, boys. So glad I crossed over the line. Oh, yeah.
Ishmael Reed will now read from his latest novel, Flight to Canada.
I'm going to read chapter 1 of the novel, Flight to Canada. And the first chapter opens with a mixture of interior monologue, stream of consciousness, and narrative, generally based upon the thoughts of one of the fugitive slaves who has escaped from the plantation in Virginia. His name is Raven Quickskill, and he's a writer. And after this chapter, the novel does a flashback to the period, more or less, of the Civil War. Little did I know, when I wrote the poem, Flight to Canada, that there were so many secrets locked inside its whirl. It was more of a reading than a writing. Everything it said seems to have caught up with me. Other things are running away. The black in my hair is running away. The bad spirits who were in me left a long time ago. The devil who was catching up with me is slipping behind and losing ground. What a war it was. Lincoln, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Douglas, Jeff Davis and Lee, me, 40s, and Stray Leachfield, Robin and Judy, Princess Qua Qua Tralaralara, Mammy Barracuda, Cato the Griffato, Yankee Jack, Pompey, Bangalang, It affected us all, one way or the other. Quote, "So you're the little woman who started the big war," Lincoln was supposed to have said. Received Harriet Beecher Stowe in the White House, only to have her repay his courtesy by spreading the rumor that he was illiterate. They were always spreading rumors about Lincoln, that he and his son Todd were drunks, that Mrs. Lincoln was mad, that he was a womanizer, that his mother Nancy Hanks was a slut. The Confederates said that he was a nigger. Who's to say what is fact and what is fiction? Old Harriet, naughty Harriet, accusing Lord Byron of pornography. She couldn't take to Lincoln. She liked nobility. Curious. The woman who was credited with ruining the planters was a toady to nobility, just as they were. Strange history. Complicated, too. It will always be a mystery, history. New disclosures are as bizarre as the most bizarre fantasy. Harriet caught some of it. She popularized the American novel and introduced it to Europe. Uncle Tom's Cabin. Writing is strange, though. The story caught up with her. The story she borrowed from Josiah Henson. Harriet only wanted enough money to buy a silk dress. Yet the paper mills ground day and night. She read Josiah Henson's book. That Harriet was alert. The Life of Josiah Henson, Formerly a Slave. 70 pages long. It was short, but it was his. It was all he had. His story. A man's story is his gree-gree, you know. Taking his story is like taking his gree-gree. The thing that is himself, it's like robbing a man of his etheric double. People pine away. It baffles the doctors the way some people pine away for no reason. For no reason, somebody has made off with their etheric double, has crept into the hideout of themselves and taken all they found there. Human hosts walk the streets of the cities, their eyes hollow, the spirit gone out of them. Somebody has taken their story. Josiah Henson went away and fell in love with wood. Nobody could take his wood, his walnut boards. He took his walnut boards to England and exhibited them at the Crystal Palace, met the young Queen Victoria. Nobody could take away his dawn, his settlement in Canada. Harriet gave Josiah credit in her The Key to Uncle Tom's Cabin. What was the key to her cabin? Strange woman, that Harriet. Josiah would never have thought of waging a plot-toting suit against her. Couldn't afford one anyway. Besides, he was bad at figures. His dawn went broke because he was trusting and bad at figures. It's unfortunate when a man's dawn goes broke, leaving him hopeless and frustrated. When I see those two men in the New York Times in a booth, in a fancy restaurant, two bald-faced, jaded men sitting there, rich as Creole candy, discussing the money they're going to make from the musical versions of Uncle Tom's Cabin, and they have those appetizers in front of them, and three kinds of wine. When I see that, and when I see their agent in the National Era swimming in the ocean with his chow dog, I wonder why won't the spirits go out to Long Island and touch him. Touch him for what he did to Josiah Henson. Touch him like they touched Harriet. Harriet paid. Oh, yes, Harriet paid. When you take a man's story, a story that doesn't belong to you, that story will get you. Harriet made enough money on someone else's plot to buy thousands of silk dresses and beautiful homes. One of those spacious frame mansions of bland, hospitable mien which the New England joiners knew so well how to build. A Virginia plantation in New England. Henson had to sell his dawn, his settlement, to pay his creditors. Is there no sympathy in nature? Dawn, that's a pretty name. Are people lost because the gods have deserted when they said they never would? They promised they never would. Are they concealing themselves to despite the mean-minded who are too unimaginative to recognize the new forms they've given themselves? Are they rebuking us for our stupidity? They are mean and demanding. They want to be fed. But before you can feed, you have to recognize. They told Josiah Henson to behave with gentlemanly dignity. But the common people knew. Gide knew. Gide is here. Gide is in New Orleans. Gide got people to write parodies and minstrel shows about Harriet. How she made all that money. Black money. That's what they called it. The money stained her hands. When Lord Byron came out of the grave to get her, the cartoon showed Harriet leaving her dirty stains all over Byron's immaculate and idealized white statue. Did Josiah Henson do this? The man so identified with Uncle Tom that his home in Dresden, Canada, is called Uncle Tom's Museum? Did Tom have the power the Brazilians say he has? Does he know roots? Umbanda, Pretro Veils, Pa Tamos, Pa Tamo, the cure. Did Tom make Byron's ghost rise out of his undead burial place of romance and strangle Harriet's reputation, so that one biographer entitled a chapter dealing with the scandal, Catastrophe? Do the old African and Indian gods walk the land as the old ones said they would, too proud to reveal themselves to the mean-minded who won't pay attention, too hard-headed and mean-minded to see? Harriet's hoodoo book, quote, "I was an instrument of the Lord," hoodoo writing. Did the Lord still talk? Did the Lord still walk? Are they writing this book? Will they go out to Long Island and touch these men who were musing in the restaurant about the money they were going to make on the musical comedy Uncle Tom's Cabin? Will they get the old mummy grip? Harriet said that Byron was fucking her sister. She said that she'd gotten it from her friend, Lady Byron, who, she felt, had been slandered by Countess Guccioli, Byron's last mistress and the tramp of the Tulare Gardens. Harriet accused Byron and his half-sister, Augusta Lee, of sharing lustful embrace. Is that why Harriet, the spinster, referred to Lord Byron as a brilliant, seductive genius? Watch what you put down on the page, Harriet. Did Harriet want to trade paces with Augusta Lee and transform Byron, her brother, into Henry? History sure is complicated. Or can you, like Stray Leachfield, cash your way out of history? Why isn't Edgar Allan Poe recognized as a principal biographer of that strange war? Fiction, you say? Where does fact and fiction begin and fiction leave off? Why does a perfectly rational in its own time often sound like mumbo-jumbo? Where did it leave off for Poe, prophet of a civilization buried alive, where, according to witnesses, people were often whipped for no reason? No reason? Will we ever know, since there are so few traces left of the civilization the planters call the fairest civilization the sun ever shone upon, and the slaves called Satan's kingdom? Poe got it all down. Poe says more in a few stories than all the volumes by historians. Volumes about that war, the Civil War, the Spirit War, Douglas, Tubman, and Bibb, all believing in omens, consulting conjure, and carrying unseen amulets on their persons. Lincoln, the American Christ, who died on Good Friday. Harriet saying that God rode Uncle Tom's cabin. Which God? Some God will mount any horse, even the spinster schoolteacher, crawling like an animal from the sightseeing bus toward an Umbanda temple with no a priori beliefs, as they say. Dressed in white planter's pants, white waistcoat, and white shoes, Raven Quickskill dines alone at the end of a long white Virginia table. He has just consumed a good old southern meal of plum pudding, wild duck, oyster soup, and Madeira wine, the kind of meal Kentucky generals used to sup at Jeff Davis' White House in Montgomery before the South was reduced to cornbread and molasses. All of the boarders had left the castle for the weekend, all 50 of them, craftsmen from all over the South, blacksmiths, teachers, sculptors, writers. Uncle Robin had become exultant when Quickskill first made the suggestion. He hadn't been able to figure his way out of his inheritance. He and Judy traveled a lot. Now they were in the Ashanti Holy Land. Their last trip out, they had brought back some serpents. They had given Quickskill the whole first floor of their castle. It was airy and had big spacious rooms. Mountains, meadows, and Atlantic Ocean could be seen through the windows. Quickskill would write Uncle Robin's story in such a way that using a process the old curers use to lay hands on that story would be lethal to the thief. That way, Uncle Robin would have the protection that Uncle Tom, Josiah Henson, didn't. Or did he merely use another technique to avenge his story, breathing life into Byron? Raven has a Richmond newspaper spread out in front of him. Princess Quaqua has been arrested, carrying a 15-foot balance pole, two American flags at each end, while walking on the steel cables of the Golden Gate Bridge. In the photo, crowds were hurling pellets at the officers for interfering with Quaqua's act. She was beginning to become an international event, and the media speculated about her every action. She was becoming the female Blodine, a characterization she resented. Why don't they call him the male Quaqua Tralarala, she once protested in an interview. This is not to say that she became a media bug. She insisted on her privacy, and occasionally there were photos of her wandering about her husband's yacht nude, wearing sunglasses, as he docked off Trinidad, Mallorca, or Sausalito. The note she had left Quickskill on the dresser of the Eagle Hotel had merely read, "Gone South," with her signature scrawled underneath. He had sent a note to her in care of her agent. "Dear Quaqua, wherever or whoever, maybe one day people of your class will realize that people of my class must grovel, worm, and root our way through life, fending off bad birds so we've little time to take those we love under our wing, and that we become like the mythical goofus birds, invented by lumbermen, I think, who fly backwards and build their nests upside down. We get smashed, and our endings are swift." And she wrote back, "Dear Raven, and I thought our people were bad, worshipping bears, turtles, ravens, coyotes, and eagles. But your people worship any old thing, or make an object of reference of just about any new things, as in that hoodoo expression you once taught me, only ghosts hate new things. And then that morning I saw you in our berth on the steamer Lake Erie, mumbling before it. The typewriter was sitting there, and seemed to be crouched like a black frog with white clatter for teeth. You thought I was asleep. And it went on that way until one day she signed a letter, 'See you soon,' And that was that. She'd be back. She always came back. And they always had quarrels about the human condition, as her Columbia professors would say. Flight to Canada was a problem. It made him famous, but it also tracked him down. It had pointed to where he, Forties, and Stray Leachfield were hiding. It was their bloodhound, this poem, Flight to Canada. It had tracked him down, just as his name had. The name his mother gave him before she went away into the fog woman. It had dogged him. Evil dogs us. Yes, indeed. His poem flew just as his name had flown. Raven, a scavenger to some, a bringer of new light to others. The one who makes war against the Genooks of this world. As quick on his opponents as a schooner on a slaver. Flight to Canada had given him enough men to live on. Flight to Canada had taken him all the way to the White House, where he shook hands with Abe the Player, as history would call him. He had never gotten along with Uncle Robin in slavery, but away from slavery, they were the best of friends. He would try to live up to the confidence Robin had in him by writing a good book. You put witchery on the word, Robin said. He would try to put witchery on the word. Uncle Robin had turned down an offer from Jewett and Company, of Boston's best-known writer, and had put his story in the hands of Quickskill. Now, you be careful, my story, Robin said. Treat that story as precious as old Swill treated his whips. They both knew what that meant. Bang Lang came into the room from the kitchen. She was about to leave for the Frederick Douglass houses, where she and her husband lived. His carriage was outside waiting for her. Is there anything else I can get for you? She asked Quickskill. No, he said, and then, Bang-a-lang? Yes, Quickskill. She had gotten a little gray. They had all gotten a little gray. Do you hear from Mammy Barracuda and Cato the Graffata? Last I heard, she sang, before the last reunion of the Confederate soldiers. They, what happened, Bang-a-lang? She began to laugh. She sang a chorus from Dixie. Well, I have to tell you, when she got to those lines that go, we'll run away, Mrs. took a decline, oh, her face was the color of bacon rind, oh, the old soldiers took Mammy on their shoulders and marched her out from the convention hall. Cato was leading the parade like a cheerleader, I'm telling you. Well, if you need something else, there's an apple pie in the kitchen. She turned and walked up. Curious, even in the Confederate anthem, there was a bell fading away and losing her color. What was this fascination with declining bells in the South? What was the South all about? I'll have to include all of this in my story, Quickskill thought. Quickskill drank his coffee. He had a swell. His belly was up again. He spent so much time in thought he forgot about his stomach. That was writing business, all right. He'd been writing ever since he could remember. His flight to Canada was to him what blacks were to old Abe. Abe Lincoln's last card, or Rouge et Noir, was a caption under the wood engraving printed in Punch magazine. It showed Lincoln beating a Confederate with his ace of spades. Inside the card's black spades was a grinning Negro. The engraving was done by Sir John Tenniel, a royalist. He'd have to write all of this in Robin's story. Raven was the first one of Swill's slaves to read, the first to write, and the first to run away. Master Hugh, the bane of Frederick Douglass, said, if you give a nigger an inch, he'll take an L. If you teach him how to read, he'll want to know how to write. This accomplished, he'll be running away from himself. Master Hugh could have taught Harriet Beecher Stowe a thing or two.
You're playing with the whole idea of the flight to Canada, because Canada stood for a goal, an ideal place.
Charles Ruas, Ishmael Reed.
From the beginning, when slaves were brought here to the United States, there was always a yearning to get out of it, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean,
if you're in it, you want to get out of it. And there were even fantasies the slaves had about slaves flying back to Africa. You know, there are these stories you find in folklore of slaves taking off and actually flying back to Africa. So the Atlantic, it was pretty difficult to traverse at that time. And so the logical place to go was to go north. And, you know, we had a diagram of all the routes that one could take to the Underground Railroad to Canada. And so Canada became a symbol of freedom long before Harriet Beecher Stowe treated the theme. She just popularized the idea of oppression and slavery because, she was white, number one. And, you know, she had a good publisher and good distribution. You know, the kind of distribution that we could still envy because, you know, in towns all across America, people waited for each installment of Flight to Canada. Oh, excuse me. I hope they wait for each installment all across America for my book, Flight to Canada. But at that time, the 19th century, they waited for Harriet Beecher Stowe's book. You know, it was serialized in the national era, and everybody would be waiting whole families would be waiting for each installment, and people would get together with their friends. Great, remarkable period. Can you imagine people all getting together with their friends and neighbors and reading a book aloud, you know, in their living room? So that's the kind of fantastic reception she got. But the theme had been treated before. As a matter of fact, William Wells Brown treated the theme, and his book, Clotel of the President's Daughter, was supposed to be replied to Harriet Beecher Stowe. And that's one of the things I tried to achieve, is that there's always been this mission or this desire among Afro-American writers to tell their version of Uncle Tom's Cabin, you know, all the way back to the 19th century. So I think I've succeeded, and maybe, you know, this will rival Harriet Beecher Stowe's success. Ha! Lots of luck. But I grew up in Buffalo, which was the last stop.
The last stop before the border.
Before the border, right. And people were ferried across in Black Rock Ferry. And I remember when I was a kid, we used to go to this church on Michigan Avenue. It was a church founded in the 1840s by free slaves. And in the basement of this church, there were actual shelves where the slaves would hide out. And I think some progressive minister came up and moved that church to other places, but it's still standing there. And I think, you know, somebody ought to make it into a museum. But it was very significant. Living in Buffalo, where Canada was so nearby, and you had access to all these legends, you know, the idea that the fugitive slave writers and a lot of the fugitive slaves and a lot of the vital activity surrounding the issue took place in Buffalo, anti-slavery rallies. There was the anti-slavery movement in Western New York, where I come from. So it was logical that I would eventually tackle the theme.
You find Harriet Beecher Stowe thoroughly reprehensible.
Not thoroughly reprehensible. She does what many, you know, white writers and artists have always done, is that they feel that nobody pays attention to black artists, and so they use their material. They help themselves to their material. I think that was just a case recently where some, you know, black musicians who had written He's So Fine,
yes,
you know, won a suit from one of the Beatles, who helped himself to the music, you see. That happens all the time. It's still happening.
Yes. When you say that, I mean, the most recent case that comes to my mind is Nat Turner.
Right.
By William Styron. Well, Did you feel that way?
I don't think that's exactly the same thing. What I'm saying is that often white artists will plagiarize Afro-American artists, because many Afro-American artists are not aware of the copyright laws, and, you know, they just get careless with their contracts, and their stuff becomes public domain. And, you know, that's a problem. I don't think that's the same thing as, in all fairness to William Styron, as, you know, someone taking a court record or a confessional or small material and expanding that into a novel. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's the same thing. I think it's okay for someone to write about Afro-American themes. We have white characterizations. I have this long section here with a dialogue between Abraham Lincoln and Arthur Sewell. That's because I know both cultures. Like the African theory of hunting, you know, which is an apt definition of the kind of characterization I'm involved in, is if you want to hunt the cheetah, you become the cheetah, so you can match up the cheetah's every move. And so I can have empathy with white characters, and so I think white writers can have empathy with black characters. Whether they're successful or not depends upon the writer.
What do you object to in Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin?
Well, she actually took Josiah Henson's
narrative.
It's an autobiography that she used. That's correct, and used a considerable amount of material in her book, Uncle Tom's Cabin, without cutting the guy in on the royalties or whatever. I don't know how many people are going to get this, but in Brazil, the character Uncle Tom is a loa, or a spirit, that's celebrated. And in Brazil, Uncle Tom is a healer, a botanist, a hungan. There is a group of docile loas that are celebrated in Brazil. With this understanding, I would say that it's quite possible that, using the liberties available to the novelist and the fiction writer, that Josiah Henson got even with her through Lord Byron.
Uh-huh.
Because when Harriet Beecher Stowe raises scandal about Lord Byron committing incest with his sister, it almost ruined her career. That was such a backlash on her. And so it happens all the time. The author will help himself to the plot and some of the characterizations of an Afro-American writer. And now I understand that this author's has some of the biggest remainders in history, where millions of copies are coming back, you know, like a multi-million dollar flop. And the film that he's making is in difficulty, you know, and I understand the New York Times is very depressed. One could very well form a Bodoon explanation for this, based upon Bodoon or what we call in America voodoo.
But you, on looking back at history, mm-hmm. you're always amazed at how incongruous and unreal the record of real deeds is. And so that in your fiction, you're constantly juxtaposing, like, the present and the past.
Yeah. I not only do that because, well, painters do this.
Yes.
Musicians do it. a modern musician like Ornette Coleman might refer to Duke Ellington in a passage in a solo. That's contemporary, and it might be something that was written years ago by Duke Ellington. Painters do it all the time, where they can do collages using material taken from different periods of time. And I don't see any reason why the writer can't do the same thing. Except I don't think writing is considered a fine art in this country. It's considered, you know, a way of telling a story or giving a message or something like that. It's not considered a fine art. So I'd say my work is extra literary because I'm influenced a great deal by sculpture and music and the other arts.
Were you consciously using a collage technique or a montage technique?
Certainly. My earliest influence was Nathaniel West, who maybe didn't do this as successfully as he could have done, I think, if he had survived, but reading his writing. I was in New York, and I knew a lot of painters and musicians, but I think maybe in the 20s, if you read the records of people in the 20s and earlier, they associated mostly with other writers.
So that in reading the novel Flight to Canada, you get very clearly a sense of the sort of timeless flight to Canada, not only during the Civil War, but that the Civil War is a continuous experience.
Yes, well, certainly I think slavery is contemporary. I think it's also a theory of voodoo or vodoom, which is a very sophisticated system of ideas and art forms, although it's got a bad reputation in this country. I'm trying to improve that. My company, our company, Reed Cannon & Johnson, we're trying to introduce books into the United States by vodoom scholars and scientists. And vodoom, you know, the past is present. The past is contemporary. Certain heroes or gods who are ancient or heroes who took place in wars against the French, for example, in the 18th century in Haiti appear. People communicate with them, and certain art objects are contemporary. If you go to a museum, if you go up to the Met down the street there, you'll see Egyptian art, and it's contemporary.
It is contemporary.
Ancient art, but I mean, it's present and it's real, you know.
My understanding of voodoo is that basically, in terms of, let's say, the religion, that it's a nature religion, right, which in this country and in Haiti is a nature religion blended with, in Haiti would be Catholicism.
Well,
form
it's able to blend with a lot of forms. It's able to blend with Native American religions and European religions and art forms, and it's very adaptable. For example, I did an article for Lee Magazine, which is coming out in January, on my experiences in New Orleans at the Mardi Gras. I covered the Mardi Gras. And what I've taken upon myself is to go around the Americas covering these carnivals and festivals, you know, which have African themes and Native American elements. Oscar Wilde said that the carnival is a true pageant of the people. And I think that it's like everybody's local mysteries or sacred mysteries on foot. You know, people are parading all the gossip and all the folklore, you know, and you can take pictures of it and it's there. You know, all the record is intact. It's like the tarot cards or something of every town or every civilization. I found that Edmund Wilson, who was interested in vodoom, made this statement that when he was in Haiti around Christmas, he found that there were serpents on the Christmas cards along with the Christian themes, you know?
Yes.
And like, I just did an article for Rolling Stone on Haiti, which I was proofing before I came up here, but they're going to bring out in December, January, where it was remarkable. I went to the Episcopalian Church in Port-au-Prince. I went in there and the murals that have been painted by the naive, so-called naive painters were full of like vodoom symbols. You know, you get like Christ's Last Supper, but you get an Urzuli, the goddess of the sea in there, you know, and all this. And or you get the wedding feast of Canaan, and you get like somebody sacrificed a boar. It's really weird. There's always a backwoods interpretation of this stuff that we hear has been handed down in America, but I think it's also very modern, very sophisticated, and adaptable to you know, art forms, where the Haitian artist or the vodoom artist uses certain universals to which he brings his own individual expression.
Mm-hmm. Because it's a rich and very current mythology.
Certainly.
That can draw everything to itself.
Right. And so, you know, we have scientists using language that one would consider traditionally used by vodoom people, like the idea of telepathy and precognition traditionally associated with vodoom, you know, psychokinesis and all this, you know.
With this interest in voodoo, are you also interested in the Creole society of which this was the main spirit or the underlying spirit?
Well, they really found upon it. It was really the peasants are the ones who kept it in, you know, alive in other countries. But they're also Creole versions of it or upper-class versions of it.
Is that the distinction you'd make?
It's so varied. And it leaves so much room for, you know, individual expression or, you know, local expression. There are all kinds of pageants and celebrations in Haiti, but they don't necessarily take place on the same date. It allows for a great deal of variety. The higher you rise, or the higher you go in the hierarchy, you know, or the class or the caste system, you find subtler interpretations of it. Like in Brazil, they have a thing called Kardec, which the upper classes practice, which has something to do with oral healing and very, you know, sophisticated things like that. And we just found out, for example, they've invented a camera which takes pictures of auras. So there are auras. They do exist. And so, you know, today's superstition or today's folklore is tomorrow's science. But I use this philosophy in my novels, and sometimes I use actual Bodum characterizations, which many people can't recognize and consider incoherent. But, you know, bebop was considered incoherent in the 1940s, and now we got bebop background music on the Merv Griffin Show. Give it a little time.
You know. You really have a sense of the ironies of history.
Oh, certainly.
Are you fascinated by, like, the Creole society of the Louisiana area?
I think
the territory, I guess.
I think that the Creoles, the Creoles have a very, I don't know, it's very difficult to pinpoint what that term means. For example,
which is what I'm leading you to, as you can
see. Some people say Creoles are, the blacks who were born in America. The
yes.
first generation born in America were called Creoles. Some
yes.
say it's like people are who are half French and half black. Some say it's a term of derogation that the French used against the Spanish when they, people who were still Spanish in Louisiana. So there are many interpretations of it.
My understanding in general would be the hybrid of African culture
onto whether
French or Spanish or European culture.
Certainly. I don't know about the politics of it, but the aesthetics of it are remarkable.
And are remarkable.
Satisfying as far as I can see. I think New Orleans, where, the synthesis took place, is probably the most charming and most sophisticated and most beautiful city in the United States.
What about then in your novel, for example, Swill, although he's decadent, remains like so far apart from the reality around him, and you really have this fantastic play.
That's the way it was. The Southern aristocracy was living out of fantasy, and the Arthurian thing is not so far-fetched because they were reading that literature. All the Southern gentlemen reading Tennyson and Sir Walter Scott, and they were really trying to create a replica of feudalism, which sounds absurd to us. But people at that time were horrified. It was incredible to the aristocracy in Europe. Everybody else had abandoned slavery as an anachronism.
Yes.
And they were still practicing these ideas. So it's really definitely a society living under an illusion. And I think Tennessee Williams and Southern writers capture that there was really, they were living in a dream world.
In a dream. But the thing is, I guess most people can't accept that the U.S. and Russia both had serf or slave feudalism at that time.
That's right.
It's one of my premises that the South is a feudal society, and even today it has remnants of that
feudal
system. With the whole concept of feudalism, you have the fact that every individual is tied to the soil. In your novel, for example, Flight to Canada, you really sort of survey all of the U.S. in that period. I mean, not only, Lincoln and Niagara Falls and so on. But
that was very interesting that the Southern aristocracy fought the Northern armies, which was made up of the descendants of the European serfs, which is the irony, one of these ironies you find in history. I think that's the noblest in the last great war that the United States participated in, the Civil War, because that was a clear-cut conflict between the common man and feudalism. And I think at that time, feudalism was supposed to have been ended for all time.
Mm-hmm.
It lingers on, I think, as a poetry movement, with people like Pound who praise despots and who are into some kind of pseudo-Orientalism. I put quote marks around there where certain decadent, quote marks, Oriental aristocracies are paid homage to. And, we got that in California now, all these feudalists living off the mountains with their groupies and their entourages, who are like anti-democratic,
But I wanted to ask you, like a serf is basically, by definition, someone really tied to the soil.
Right.
And eventually, let's say, in countries where they eventually won their soil, like during the French Revolution, you have a sort of passionate attachment even today, right? But you see the slaves of the South as really wanting to fly, run away from that rather than to win it.
They did. They did. That was the most significant protest.
Mm-hmm.
Against the institution that a slave could make. They could handle these little revolts like Nat Turner. I mean, all this attention to Nat Turner, I think, is racist in a sense that, I do not wish to deny the heroic possibilities of his feat.
Of the man,
yes. Certainly. But it is an attempt by, I think, European-American historians to limit the strategies that, Afro-Americans use to change their conditions. But I'm trying to say in this book that there were other strategies.
Yes.
Not the most obvious and literal-minded strategies. That's why people like boxing. That's why maybe Muhammad Ali can get on the Face the Nation, our scholars and intellectuals and people like that can't.
Mm-hmm.
It's because they want to keep us to the most literal-minded techniques. And this is not to disparage, Muhammad Ali's beauty and integrity and talent. It's just that it's a sport that grew out of slavery. Boxing, You know, if you go to see Mandingo and Vrum, I went to see them, and fortunately I went into a black theater. I wish I had a tape recorder because the comments coming from the audience were better than the flick. You know? people hated Mandingo and Vrum because they were accurate. I don't know who put these films together, but that's the way it was. It was really sorry and decadent, and it was vile, and it was sadistic, and it was really, you know, humanity at its worst and the most depraved going on in the South. And everybody called it decadent. You know, that's why I say Edgar Allan Poe got it all down, you know, all this incest and the undead and all this kind of thing. But in Mandingo, for example, you saw that everybody tolerated these guys beating each other up. But when they saw the nigga trying to read a book, you see, or getting too educated or learned, they'd gouge his eye out or something like that, you see. So that was the protest that the more sophisticated slaves made. They absented themselves. In other words, they took their property away. And the South was built upon slave labor. And that was the most vital protest. When you ran away from it, that they were losing their property. You hit them in their pocketbooks. And other slaves got the message, and a lot of them ran away. That was a threat against the institution. These people were running away from slavery. And they were usually house blacks, too. It was usually house blacks who ran away because they could hear all the information at the dinner tables about what was going on and what rights were available to them. And they had access to the political issues of the times, which were being discussed. And they had all the gossip, and they knew, you know, what was going on in Canada and all these things.
If I go back to Nat Turner, I mean, I can see where you're saying that people are elaborating on a historically futile, although heroic, gesture in the sense that he was sure to be eventually destroyed.
Well, they won't give us the same wide range of strategies and tactics for changing our condition as they would give the whites. For example, the most important revolution that took place in the West was the Cultural Revolution. I mean, Christ entered the city on the back of an ass because they all read that in a book. You know, they were all intellectuals, and Christ and his followers were scholars, and they planned it quite well. It was like really a brilliant example of agitprop theater. They changed the West's mind. They changed the psychology of the West. That's the most significant revolution that's ever taken place.
But let me ask you to speculate. Do you think that the South eventually would have faced the same situation as Haiti, where the organized culture would take over?
Yeah, they were afraid of Haiti. Yes. They were always, when the Haitians revolted, that really gave the Southern planters the willies because they thought it would spread to the North. And there's this amazing cartoon I refer to by a Southern cartoonist that I refer to in the We Magazine article, which will be out in December, in which Lincoln is shown signing the Emancipation Proclamation, and there are all kinds of demons, and you know, Southern the Confederates really developed an art form out of Haiti Lincoln. You know, there were really brilliant plays that they wrote, and you know, paintings and cartoons, and they call him the Illinois Ape and Baboon and all these things. And they showed Lincoln signing the diabolical, sinister Lincoln signing the Emancipation Proclamation with demons and devils appearing and harpies all around. And above his head, above the fireplace, was a painting entitled Santo Domingo in Haiti, you know. And it showed the blacks killing the planters, you know, with machetes and things. I saw the cartoon, and I must give credit. It's a remarkable book that Doubleday published, which they gave me on the Civil War with many color plates and fantastic paper, and really a work of art the book was, but that's one of the things I used in the book. They were afraid of Haiti, and there is a great deal of evidence that the Haitian Revolution against the French was a Vaudoun Revolution. It was begun by, in 1791, by a Hungan, a priest named Boukman, who rallied the countryside through Vaudoun, because Vaudoun was a way for all the nations that found themselves in the New World from Africa. Vaudoun is one thing that, the common denominator for all their beliefs. You know, that's the synthesis of everything that they brought, their value systems, and that brought them together.
And as I understand it, since it could readily adapt and use, let's say, the Catholic Church in Haiti, that the churches were one of the means of communication for the revolt.
The Catholic Church has been at times tolerant and at times suppressive of these movements, and I think it's coming around now to being tolerant. The Pope had issued a document in which he called for educating the priesthood to non-Western mentality. Instead of being hostile to the non-Western mentality and its rites and rituals, to actually learn from it. And I've seen evidence of this happening. I know a few Jesuits, and, you know, we have these conversations. And, you know, I see evidence of this happening, that they are tolerant. You know, that's why they've been around for 2,000 years. And, you know, Protestantism is a recent religion, a recent form of Christianity, and probably is on the way out. Protestantism is quite intolerant.
It's the most intolerant.
That's why Jimmy Carter, at one time, may be a good thing, and at the other time, And my other one voice says it's a good thing to give American populism another chance. And my other voice says, well, maybe, you know, he might be more of a threat than Ford. I grew up in the South, you know, we were Methodists because Tennessee was a Methodist state, you know. In the 19th century, they say Methodism spread through Tennessee like wildfire, you know. So we had belonged to the same church as John Wesley Hardin, you know. Uh-huh. Gunfire. So, you know, when he says born again is one of the tenets. But there's also another one, the call, which mm-hmm. probably has a Vodun origin, you know, where someone would get called when a god or goddess wants you to be their priest. They come to you in dreams and beckon you. And I've had this happen to me. I was beckoned. And this actually happened. I had textbook dreams where I was beckoned by Damballa first, and then secondly by Erzuli, and now the Gides. And I think I'm more at home with the Gides because they're low as a satire. And they are comedians, and they're statesmen, and they're gangsters, and they're politicians, and they're artists, you know. And Dubailleur was a Gide, Baron Samedi, you see. But I think that might have been something borrowed, might have been something borrowed from the Haitian vote on this idea of being called. I can just see Jimmy Carter in the governor's mansion, you know.
Being called, too.
Yeah, Christ, and, you know, Christ having a vision of Christ, and Christ saying, you know, it's you, Jimmy. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty, you know, that leads to the kind of fanaticism. I hope that's not the case where, you know, he believes he has some kind of holy mission to be president.
Do you feel, then, like a need to debunk the romanticism around Lincoln? You know, Lincoln the Savior killed on Good Friday.
I think Lincoln was a shrewd politician.
A Machiavellian, brilliant.
Well, farmer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the farmers cut through all the You know, you read you read writers from the Midwest. They're very sparse, and they're a few words. And they cut through all the stuff, you know. Like, you read Strunk, Elements of Style, which is a composition book by Midwesterners, you know, that's cut out all the fat. Just get right to the point. And I think Lincoln had that kind of shrewd intelligence. And I think he did some masterful things. And if you read about the guy, you can't help from liking him. But I don't think he was any holy man or any godlike figure. And I think when Nixon says that he's very much like Lincoln, he might have had a point, you know. Because Lincoln was a military dictator, you know, for a while. After Fort Sumter, he told Congress not to even come back until the 4th of July. Suspended Parliament. You know.
The other thing I wanted to
And he was also a corporation lawyer.
A corporation lawyer. And his son really became a corporation lawyer.
Sure, but I mean, I wasn't out to debunk Lincoln. I just read a lot of material and read his speeches and picked up his style, so I was able to write in his style. I used liberties with it, you know. Mm-hmm.
The other thing I wanted very much to ask you in the satire of the book is, for me, I've always felt or known that basically the blacks and the whites of the South are intimately related.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Do you know? And my fascination with Creole culture, that's accepted, acknowledged.
The doctor who shot Huey Long, shot it because Huey Long had spread the rumor that he was a black man. It comes up all the time. I think Du Bois says that the African race disappeared after a couple of generations. You know, this is so much a mix-up.
Yes.
And you see this in many Afro-American families that they have, like, a European-American branch. I know in my own case, I learned it somewhere from my grandmother. I never bothered to ask her, you know. But, you know, I said, well, you know, where do we come from? She says, well, your great-great-grandfather was an Irishman, you know, Alabama, who disowned his son for marrying a black woman, who disowned his sister for marrying a white man. So, you know, it's all crazy, and there are Cherokees wandering in and out of the family, and Plains Indians. People, you know, I guess they were pretty bored when everybody came here, so they resorted to the cheapest recreation. it wasn't even a campaign issue, you know. And one of Lincoln's campaigns where he talked about they were afraid that the blacks came, you know, north, they'd get in everybody's bedrooms. Lincoln actually cited statistics where, you know, there were like 300,000 mulattoes born that year. He said, well, he didn't really desire to have any black women himself. And I use that quote in Scholastic magazine. They censored it. Can you imagine that?
But why do you think in this country there's that whole myth of a separation of the races, whereas in every other culture in the New World or the Old World, or in the Far East, it's basically an accepted fact with different attitude towards it. And yet here, there's really no trend towards accepting the fact that it's, you know, all the peoples are interrelated. Mm-hmm. I mean, very intimately.
I don't know if that's really true. I don't know, I was in the South when I was 18, and I went there last year, and it was very much different from the way I remembered it, that all these things were accepted. I mean, you know, it's pretty mixed up. Things that people were doing, things that they right out front that they get lynched for 20 years ago. So I think that's all changing.
That is changing.
I don't know. I think they're all relatives down there. you look at them, you know, yes, closely and listen to them talk, I think they're probably all relatives. So there's a lot of cohabitation mm-hmm. between the races, between the whites and the blacks, between the blacks and whites and the Indians, and so, you know, it's all mixed up.
My final question is, Canada was also a center for the Confederacy during the Civil War.
Right. Yeah, the Confederate emissaries went to Toronto and had meetings and tried to, you know, get support from the Canadian government.
And to draw England into the war on the...
Right. Right. I went to Canada. That's where I got the idea for the ending, which I won't reveal here on the air.
No. You know. But one of the things that occurs in Canada that amused me no end is that long, that sort of argument in the cafe between...
Oh, that was an emancipated city, right?
I
create this imaginary city in the United States called Emancipated City. And you're referring to Mel Lear.
Yes, I am.
The Jewish immigrant and the Afro-American writer Raven Quickskill arguing over whose people have suffered the most.
Yeah, yes.
Sure. Well, that happens a lot. I mean, you can pick up some magazines in this town and see that argument still going on.
Yeah. Especially in this town.
Yeah, right. And now I'll go to chapter 22. And this takes place after the defeat of the Confederacy. What the American Arthurians couldn't win on the battlefield will now be fought out on the poetry field. Lincoln, the Saxon chief, is slain. Lincoln, London, two towns in Britain. Lincoln, London, England. Lincoln, London, England. The sound, the savage sounds of rock worshippers. Quote, Anglo-Saxon was abandoned to the use of rustics and hens who knew no better. Sir Walter Scott. Sir Scott. Old man Ruffin, who fired the first shot against the Union at Fort Sumter, shot himself when he heard that Lee had surrendered. Jefferson Davis is captured, disguised in his wife's hoops, shawl, and rainproof coat. Davis' defenders say it's a lie. Historians still debate this. Oscar Wilde, the great decadent, would say, quote, his fall after such a able and gallant pleading in his own cause must necessarily arouse pity. Davis later invited the apostle of aesthetics to his Mississippi homestead, where Wilde charmed the ladies. Maybe it was Wilde's knee breeches and the sunflower pinned to the lapel of his coat that appealed to them. Raised by mammies, the South is dandyish, foppish, pimpish. Its writers are Scott, Poe, Wilde, Tennyson. Its assassin left behind a trunk in which was found, quote, clothes in fine silk, velvets, silks, ermine, and crimson, and also hats, caps, plumes, boots, shoes, etc. Davis said that he desired to carry on guerrilla warfare in the hills of Virginia. Davis missed the point. Davis, who was accused by the Charleston Mercury of treating Southerners like white Negroes, misread his people. It wasn't the idea of winning that appealed to them. It was the idea of being ravished. Decadent and Victorian writing both use the romantic theme of fair youth slumbering, fair youth daydreaming, fair youth struck down. In the New Orleans Mardi Gras, that great Confederate pageant, the cult of Endymion has a whole evening, Saturday. Davis claims he tried to wrestle his captives to the ground from their horses. He is a proud patrician with a chiseled nose and tells the Union soldier to kindly take his buckra hands off of him. The rude Yankee soldiers refer to him as Jeff, and when he is jailed, they draw cartoons of him hanging from a tree on the wall of his cell.
Listening to Charles Ruas interviewing Ishmael Reed on his recently published novel, Flight to Canada. This program was produced by Eric Bender, with editorial assistance by Michael Moss. Technical direction by David Rapkin. Thank you for listening.
This is Charles Ruas. You've been listening to a selection from my historic archives.
With the cooperation of Clock Tower, these programs have been restored for broadcast on Clock Tower Radio, operating at clocktower.org.
The previous program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.